All right. So the trick will be, can I use the technology? But so we developed an electronic medical record in Denver, actually under Case's tenure. We used to have a scan sheet, and that was actually very easy to review for the physicians because we could simply look at one sheet and pretty easy to get all the information you needed to see whether things were being done correctly under a protocol. It's actually much harder with the electronic medical record. You have to click through multiple screens, and you know, and though it sounds trivial, every click simply makes it more difficult. And so we felt we weren't necessarily doing as good a job anymore now that we had our electronic record. So just to give you a little background on us, we are an urban STD clinic, the only one actually in our local area. Our clinicians are RNs, and they work under protocols and do use this electronic medical record with physician consultation available. This, I realize, is jurisdiction-specific, potentially. Both our medical and nursing boards think nurses have brains and, in fact, are capable of doing this. I know some jurisdictions don't. But it does mean that we need to have protocols and we need to have some way of ensuring that, in fact, we're using these protocols correctly. So we had been doing the QA under this new record, really with kind of spot reviews. The physicians were trying to sign off on the charts as best we could, and so we'd look at things, and if something didn't seem right, we could send it back to the clinician with a little comment note. And it was not very satisfactory, really. So what we ended up doing is developing two EMR-based QA measures. And this really is sort of a pilot for getting a more robust QA program going. But this would allow us to review all the charts and allow us also to have assessment of individual clinician performance. We actually had done a couple of things prior to that that really related more to overall clinic performance, looking at our chlamydia treatment within a timely fashion and our syphilis treatment similarly. But that didn't depend on an individual clinician as much as it did on all of the clinic systems to make sure that was occurring. So we really wanted to be able to also look at individual clinicians. So we chose protocols for NGU and trichomoniasis. They both have point-of-care testing, which does allow the clinician to do diagnosis and treatment on the same visit. So it's all within the hands of an individual clinician on that visit. As I thought about this, to me, the fundamental purpose of a protocol is to ensure that history, physical exam findings, and lab results are interpreted correctly and treated appropriately. And whether it's a protocol that has to be in place formally for this arrangement to work in Colorado for the nurses to be the clinicians, or whether it's an algorithm you have in your head as an advanced practice provider of some sort or a physician, then that's really the purpose, is to say, I want to make sure that if the patient has the disease, that I make the right diagnosis and that I give the right treatment. On the other hand, if they don't have the disease, equally important, I should not be diagnosing them with it and I should not be giving them treatment for it. So as I thought about this, it really comes down to saying, well, what are the permutations on this? How can we go right here and how can we go wrong? I've really given you the two right scenarios. They have disease, I treated them, or they don't have it and I don't treat them. Now this slide, I'm not expecting you to be able to read it all. This is simply to say it gets complicated. You really have to think through permutations here. And I was able to come up with 8 scenarios, really, of different ways in which you could have the disease but somehow not end up at the correct box on the far left, which would say, I have it, I got the treatment, and had the appropriate diagnosis recorded. On the other hand, I also could not have it and therefore not get diagnosed with it and not get treated with it, which is the second correct one, but many ways to go wrong in all of those dashed boxes. So this was my, essentially, the logic that lay behind what I asked the programmers to do in trying to sort out people into boxes for me to say how many people are in each of these groups. And so when we started, we did actually both, as I said, NGU and TRICS. I'll start with NGU. We had done this in the past, and I had the programmers do an update for me just now, so this is within the last 6 months of our clinic work. We had 670 men who did have a gram stain done in the clinic, which generally means they had complaints of discharge, and you were actually able to do it, of course. 343 did have NGU by gram stain criteria. We use greater than or equal to 3 white cells per high powered field based on kind of the breakpoint we see about where chlamydia becomes more common in our clinic. So this does not match the CDC treatment guidelines because of local data. And of course, no gram negative intracellular diplococci stain, i.e., there's no GC on the gram stain, or it is, of course, then not non-gonococcal urethritis. 309 had appropriate diagnosis and appropriate treatment documented. So they've got NGU by gram stain criteria. We called it NGU. We treated them with either azithromycin or doxycycline. 34 had NGU but lacked either the diagnosis or the treatment. Now, this is the initial electronic review, and again, I asked the programmers to give me the buckets, sort of. And so I looked at the cases where there appeared to be a discrepancy. The 326 who did not have NGU by this criteria, similar thinking. You know, did any of them end up with treatment or with a diagnosis they shouldn't have? And it was a somewhat smaller group, only 17. But then when I did hand review on those 51 apparent errors, I discovered really only 6 were ones that I could say, you know, really the clinician did something wrong. In the other cases, what we were seeing was that my programming request had not accounted for variations in how clinicians charted when 2 diagnoses were present. So, for example, if the person was coming in as a chlamydia contact and had NGU, it mattered which one they decided to put first, because if they put the treatment with the chlamydia, then it was not getting picked up under the NGU, and it looked as though it was an error when, in fact, it was not. There are other diagnoses using the same treatment. So, for instance, persistent NGU, and actually these 2 points kind of go together. We don't have a persistent or recurrent NGU diagnosis in our chart. And it's something we have yet to fix. It's not the most common thing we see, so it hasn't been the highest priority. But clearly, the clinicians are kind of stuck. They can't use, you know, they can use the NGU diagnosis for lack of anything better, or it goes under other, but either way, it ends up looking like a problem, because now, if we follow the CDC guidelines, if they already had azithromycin, then we don't give them doxycycline, but we do give them metronidazole. And so that looks as though we just weren't treating NGU correctly. Or alternatively, if they had not had azithromycin, we could give azithromycin as well as the metronidazole. But if somebody used an other diagnosis, again, it looked as though we're giving out drugs not for NGU. So these were things I hadn't necessarily anticipated. This speaks to the need to validate if you're doing QA with an electronic medical record like this. You know, you have your program and you think it's perfect, and then when you get your results, you realize that there were these things you forgot or perhaps didn't realize about things. The first point is one I really didn't realize that we would run into this problem with how the clinicians were charting, because they would say, for example, you know, CT contact treatment, or they might even list it, but then it's not dispensed, and so you end up with these glitches in what your programming picks up for you. But then also, again, it's easy to sort of forget some of these things. I mean, I knew we didn't have that diagnosis, but didn't think of it as important. Well, it becomes important now when we start to do something like this. And then finally, there is another option. It was actually the least common under this scenario. Which is discussion with the physician leading to an off-protocol strategy, which is what is supposed to happen. And there is a note where this can be documented, but again, we're not picking that up in the electronic chart review, at least at this level. So it's not uncommon for our clinicians who are kind-hearted people to say, you know, he just urinated right before the gram stain, and he's got 2 instead of 3, but his symptoms are so classic. And, you know, they're trying to talk me into saying, okay, fine, let's call it NGU and treat him that way. And they're actually very persuasive that way, I would say. So, you know, that happens some. And not, I think, inappropriately necessarily. But then again, that's not going to look as though we did it correctly, because now they don't have the gram stain criteria. So again, this is a way of finding sometimes holes in your system, like lack of our diagnosis, or problems that you didn't know you had. And so it's, as I said, this is all sort of a pilot for us. When we looked at TRIC, there are very similar issues, so I won't necessarily repeat all the same details, but in this last 6 months, we had 832 women who had a wet prep. So generally speaking, that would mean they came in and said, I'm having a discharge or some complaint that led us that direction. 53 had TRIC by the wet prep criteria of saying there are mobile trichomonads seen on microscopy. That's actually a little bit low for us, I believe. We generally run a slightly higher rate, but 32 then had the appropriate diagnosis and appropriate treatment documented, 21 didn't. And then most of the women did not have TRIC, and none had an incorrect diagnosis or treatment. So our clinicians were never assigning a TRIC diagnosis if there was not TRIC on the wet prep, for example. And metronidazole has fewer uses, and so we did not see it appearing as something that appeared to be incorrectly distributed. But once again, when I did the hand review on these, what appeared to be errors, I found that only two of them could really perhaps be called errors. In both cases, it was a clinician who gave BV levels of treatment with no explanation why. But what one of the big issues was, again, was if a woman came in and she had both BV and TRIC, which is not uncommon, then if they listed the treatment under BV, though I had attempted to account for this, I had thought about this some in the programming request, nonetheless, again, missed this point that if it's listed under the other diagnosis, we weren't picking it up well under what we had. In this particular instance, as I said, the two instances, it's like there was no explanation about why it was BV treatment because there was not BV, there was no BV diagnosis, there was nothing in the chart to explain it. So those, I would say, true clinician errors, and the question is why. Now, rare, but discussion with physician leading to off-protocol strategy. So what this allowed us to do is determine individual clinician adherence to protocols. So if you're going to do protocols, obviously you can argue you need some kind of quality assurance. We weren't doing the best job of it recently, wanted to get back to doing a better job. If you look at just my initial programming, we actually had pretty good numbers. I mean, NGU was over 92%, TRIC over 97%. When you do the hand review to make sure you're not incorrectly assigning things, those rates shot up, and we have really excellent adherence to our protocols, as we should. So we found a couple of things, though, that we need to address, actually, that don't really relate as much to clinician performance as system performance. And that is one of the values, I think, of doing something like this. So one system issue is we haven't really said to the clinicians, here's how you should document when you have two diagnoses. And there's unfortunately, that's the game telephone or rumor where you say something to the person on one end of the room and they whisper it to the next and you see how it comes out at the end. It's always quite distorted. To a degree, on the documentation, this has been a new clinician comes in and gets told by somebody who's there how to do it. But as you have turnover of clinicians without a standardized protocol or some sort of a document that says to people, here's how you should do it, things aren't always going to be done the same way. And you have different clinicians, sometimes putting TRIC first, sometimes putting BV first, sometimes et cetera. So that would be helpful for us to just be more standardized in that. It really points out that though it's not a common problem, nonetheless, we should have the diagnosis because it's something we treat and something that ends up looking as though we're doing things incorrectly. So I'm going to put up our NGU logic at the end here, just for you to admire, while we see if there are any questions.
Questions for Dr. Peterson? Dr. Hook? Go ahead.
This is really a great illustration of some of the issues that we do encounter with EMRs, and I thank you for doing that. Many STD clinics, many of the clinics that are represented by here with the audience, not only the PTCs, do a lot of training. How do you deal with training and trainees in your EMR? We've been wrestling with that, and I realize it's a little bit off topic, but it really does have a lot to do with the issues of documentation, what we're doing, and mm-hmm. how we're doing it. Obviously, there's some trainees who come in for prolonged periods, but there are awful lot who are sort of one and done or two and done kinds of
yeah.
issues.
Yeah. So he's asking about the you know, when you have people coming in who aren't your regular clinicians. We have enough problem, obviously, with our regular clinicians. How do you handle it? To some extent, when it's just a very short course with our prevention training center, people coming in for a clinical intensive, for example, they're just there for a few days, they really aren't the ones necessarily directing the record. That really remains in the hands of the clinicians. So, so for us, that's really, I guess, how we handle that piece of it. For people who are there for a longer period of time, there is quite a learning curve about learning the electronic medical record and how to do it correctly. Once again, we have not necessarily had a specific protocol, especially on the documentation, and I think this sort of points up to the fact that, you know, we really should, along with all our other protocols, probably have one so that people can just refer to it and say, how am I supposed to do this?
Ina.
Hi, Ina Park. Oh. Is this working? Yes. Ina Park from California. I really enjoyed your presentation. Thank you so much. I have a question. I mean, given, I feel like you've clearly demonstrated that the majority of what looked like clinician error was actually a misclassification or a coding issue. So now when you go through your quality reviews, have you just decided we're not going to hand review cases anymore? We're just going to accept that there's a certain level of error? Or have you decided that you are going to periodically continue to do these hand reviews of what looks like error?
Yeah. Well, one thing actually that I had not yet gotten around to between the two audits is to say, you know, I could improve the programming some, make it a little more complex, but get around what is honestly the largest issue, which is that problem of where is the treatment documented, and so. And so the programmers are going to have to add in things like, you know, if there is BV and TRIC, look at both the BV and the TRIC, and if there's treatment for either one of them, then it's okay. We hadn't gone to that level of complexity. So I think, you know, it's not that difficult to review the number of charts I reviewed, but at the same time, it's also not probably the best use of my time. And so taking a little time up front to correct the programming, I think, is what's going to be most valuable to us. We also, by the way, are going to move on. I mean, these were sort of the low-hanging fruit in the sense of what we could do that was very clinician-specific, but there are many things in our clinic, many protocols, and so want to expand the work into other protocols. So I think my message would be just, you've got to do that review at first because you need to see how good your programming is and you may need to tweak.
Thank you.
Actually, I would like to make an additional comment and would like to get your reflection on this. So theoretically and technically, it would be possible to program your EMR so that these discrepancies would be flagged real time so that you can address them while the patient is still in the office. On the other hand, if the evaluation shows that you're already doing a job where 99% or more than 99% is correct, you can wonder if you want to go through the brain damage and cost to doing these kinds of programming jobs. On the other hand, there may be other places, for example, the dispensation of EPT or other kinds of clinic procedures that may not have the same amount of adherence, where the development of a closed loop where you're basically reminded, hey, this person is eligible for EPT, you know, have you offered this service to the patient? Any reflection on that?
Yeah, and I agree with Case. Again, I mean, we luckily it turned out that we had excellent adherence, and I think there's a couple of points about that. One, I've given feedback to the clinicians, and that's very important. I mean, it's a morale issue for the staff to at times be able to say, you're doing this well. This is great. This is stuff that we're going to look at as quality assurance now, to say we have a good process, let's keep it up. Quality improvement is really what Case is talking about, and we definitely know that there's some areas like the EPT that we could do better, or BV, for example. I anticipate when I get to that one, didn't start with it as it's not strictly a sexually transmitted disease, but although sexually associated. And we know, I think all of us empirically would say from just the previous chart review, people tend to mess that one up a lot. You know, they're not meeting 3 or 4 AMSL criteria, et cetera. So I think we will find ones like that. And then I think the question will be, how far do we take it then to put rules in to not let people finish if they've done it wrong? Or is it more of a staff education effort to help people adhere to protocols?
Tom?
Yeah, along the same lines, I'm wondering if you could just fix your record so that when a person has so many white blood cells, the diagnosis already automatically fills in with the prescription.
This is not that flexible, unfortunately. Pre-filling is not possible within the system we have. We and We are going to be moving. We're part of a big hospital system, actually. We're very unusual in that with the relationship with Denver Health and Denver Public Health. We will be moving ultimately to the Epic electronic medical record, and we'll end up using it in our clinic, too. And I don't know that it's going to be that flexible either.
Thank you. Okay, one more.
A question and a concern. How do your clinicians feel about this? Do they feel like they're being misjudged? And a concern, we do something similar in New York City in our STD clinics, and my concern has been that the clinicians learn to answer, to play with the electronic record so that they score well on whatever
sure.
indicator we're looking for.
Yeah.
And that there clearly are ways to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's always an issue, of course. You know, are people just filling things in? They're fairly busy, which means it would take actually in some ways more effort to do that than it's worth to them probably in our clinic. However, that actually relates also to a debate we've had. I've tried to say to the clinicians, look, you don't need to rewrite everything in your note because it's in the chart. And some people feel uneasy about this. Like, well, but I didn't chart it if I didn't write it out. But either way, you can say you did something you didn't do. So what's the difference? So I think you have to trust to a degree in the professionalism of your staff. I think they actually have been happy to hear it. They want to do a good job. I think it's going to depend partly, of course, on how well they're doing. And that's part of the issue here for saying, if they're doing well, tell them that, so that it's not just bad news all the time. You know, I mean, they need to hear it when they aren't doing well, but at the same time, when you legitimately can say, you're doing great, then that helps to put it in a context, I think, that makes it more palatable to hear if you aren't doing as well. Again, we're lucky at the moment. We've got a pretty good staff, and so not anticipating huge issues for any one individual or anything either. But, yeah, it could depend. I know we're also a tiny system compared to New York City, so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your attendance.